This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Tracy McRae.
And I'm Dr. John Ebert.
Dr. Shives is on assignment. Okay, really he's on vacation, but
we miss him.
Well, I like having you in the studio, so I'm glad that you're here, Dr.
It's
Ebert.
Great to be here.
Breast cancer, it's the disease that women probably fear more than anything else. And even though it's not at the top of the list of diseases that kill American women, that would be heart disease, women are still very afraid.
And about 180,000 of them will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year, and they will need treatment. That includes surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. But they also have a lot of worry, inconvenience, and disruption of their family and social life.
That's right. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, if you haven't noticed from all those pink. Are you an NFL fan? Do you see all the pink playing football players?
But aren't they getting them confused with the flags?
They are. This weekend, they're not going to have pink flags.
Okay.
They did learn that.
Okay.
Well, we're going to do our part with a discussion today about as many breast cancer-related topics as we can fit into the hour. Of course, we're not going to get them all in there, but our guests are Dr. Stephanie Hines from the Breast Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida, and Tony K. Manskow from the Cancer Education Program at Mayo Clinic in Rochester.
We'll talk about how breast cancer is being detected and share some suggestions on what to do if you or someone you know has been diagnosed. And we'll talk about the latest chapter of breast cancer, that is the genetics of the disease and the research that is being done to solve the mysteries of breast cancer.
We will get to that in just a moment. But first, today is World Arthritis Day. I didn't even get any cards from Hallmark, but today is the day of World Arthritis Day.
My joints are aching.
Did you know that osteoarthritis, as a matter of fact, may afflict as many as one in two people? Well, joining us to talk about osteoarthritis is Dr. Shirasi Amin from the Mayo Clinic Rochester. Dr. Amin, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you tell us, first of all, how is osteoarthritis different from arthritis? What is the difference there?
Well, there are many forms of arthritis, as you know, and this is the most common. And we often refer to it as the end-stage damage of a joint for many factors, but most often it's the wear and tear on the joint as we age. But it can also occur from joint damage from injuries or just overloading of the joint from being overweight, for example.
Is it such a serious problem? I guess one in two people that we do have to have a World Arthritis Day?
Well, it affects many people. It affects different joints. And the most important part is it's painful, so it affects people's function and their ability to cope and do things from work to just recreation and day-to-day activities, depending on which joint is being affected, like their hands or their knees.
Is it a situation where if you live long enough, you're going to end up with osteoarthritis?
Well, this is a type of arthritis that we do see that gets more frequent as people get older. Certain factors we think, like genetics, may play a role of having it become more frequent or occur earlier in age. But yes, as we get older, it is something that most of us will probably have at some point in some joint, especially if we've had an injury to one.
Certainly in primary care, I see a lot of patients who are coming in with osteoarthritis, and we're usually just treating the symptoms. Is there a way that we can get at the underlying disease with osteoarthritis?
Well, with osteoarthritis, though, the one that's related more to as we age or as we get older, we do, unfortunately, only have ways of managing the symptoms at this time, but we try to think about other ways of trying to prevent the arthritis to begin with. And we know that when you're overweight, that increases your risk for arthritis, especially of the knees. And so one of the things we want to try to do is, at least for many health reasons, it's important to lose weight, but especially for trying to protect some of the joints like your knees.
Can they come back? If you lose 30 or 40 pounds and you've been having trouble with your knees, can your knees recover after you've lost some of that weight?
Well, the most important part is that it does help decrease the further damage that's going to occur as the joint is worn out. So if you lose weight, that will help with decreasing that load that further damages it over time, and also will help with decreasing the pain that's often in the joint.
I heard a orthopedic surgeon tell me that for every additional pound overweight you are, there's 4 additional pounds across the joint. I don't know if that's an accurate statistic, but the point is that there's a lot of pressure put on those joints when people are overweight.
Anything else that people can do to help prevent arthritis?
Well, you know, if we try to help people, you know how to exercise properly, and if they have arthritis too, we encourage exercise, but things like walking exercises, water-based exercises, things that don't excessively load the joint but also keeps their muscles strong to protect the joint. We also feel that exercise helps them with pain management and function. And exercise is difficult, but we encourage people to meet with a therapist so they do it correctly, and so that they're doing exercises they also enjoy because they're more likely to stick with it.
Right, and some of the things we struggle with in primary care is that counterintuitive that you walk more, but I have pain, doctor, I don't want to walk, but the walking actually decreases the pain long term. We just have to get that mindset
change,
yeah.
And working with an occupational therapist, there's so many things we call assistive devices so that people don't have to strain their joint further, like opening jars if you've got arthritis for the hands, built-up grips for writing, or even recreational activities such as golf, so that people are able to maintain their function, do things, but without straining the joints further.
We skipped over one of the points that I wanted to get to, and you're kind of touching on them with these, you know, that if you are exercising, to help you cope long-term, if this is going to be a condition that you have for the rest of your life, you know, how do you best cope with that? And what are some of the other suggestions that you give to patients?
Well, in addition to, meeting with their therapist, but we talked about them, about assistive devices, good pain management strategies, but exercise is really important, not straining the joints further and trying not to injure the joints, weight loss recommendations if they are having problems with their knees especially. And exercise, doing it with good footwear and all the other things, it sounds like more common sense, but it really is important for people to be thinking about this carefully.
And talk to your doctor. I mean, your doctor sometimes can have good advice on these things.
Doctors do have helpful information.
Sometimes we do.
And what about glucosamine? Is that something that helps all patients or just some patients, or does it not help at all?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's been a number of studies looking at glucosamine and chondroitin, and the bottom line of a lot of these studies at the end of the day is that it may have really no benefit. The current recommendations from the American College of Rheumatology don't discuss glucosamine because of its little to modest effect, if anything. But what I usually tell patients is if they want to try it for 3 months, we're not aware of any serious side effects or interactions, and if they find that it helps with their knees, they can continue it. But for the most part, it's only been for most of the studies, it's been looked at for the knees, and the effects have been modest to none.
Very good. Well, happy World Arthritis Day to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Shreyasiamian, did I say your last name correct? Is that right?
It's Shreyasiamian.
Shreyasiamian. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too.
All right. It's time for a short break. But when we come back, we're going to talk with Tony K. Manscal from the Cancer Education Program at Mayo Clinic in Rochester and Dr. Stephanie Hines from Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. Plus, myth or matter of fact, a family history of breast cancer means that you are likely to develop breast cancer too. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for Tony at 507-282-1234 and Dr. Hines as well. Or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. And of course, Audrey, our producer, is ready for your tweets. Tweet us anytime. Hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Tracy McRae. Dr. Tom Shives is on assignment, and Dr. John Ebert is filling in. Good morning once again, Dr. Ebert.
Thank you.
And Dr. Stephanie Hines is joining us from Mayo Clinic Jacksonville. Good morning, Dr. Hines.
Good morning.
And finally rounding us out here in the studio, we have Tony K. Manscal from the Mayo Clinic Cancer Education Program. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
So there are so many different directions we can go with breast cancer awareness. I'm sure we could probably do a show each week in October and still not cover all the different aspects of this disease. But Dr. Hines, I'll just start with you. Do you suspect that all of this awareness that we have in October is helping women in detecting breast cancer?
Absolutely. the awareness has something, it's been there. People are talking more about it. This has been something that has been going on for a number of years. And I think the attention that it gets every year in October is also very helpful. Women read the newspaper, they listen to the TV and the radio, and they have concerns. Breast cancer is the number one cancer in women, so it's something that's in the back of every woman's mind. So I think all of the awareness and the education is key to helping women to protect themselves.
And Tony, as we walked into the building today, we were talking about how different it is now compared to even 30, 20 years ago.
Yeah. If I think back to the 1990s, I had a childhood friend whose mother was diagnosed with breast cancer, and you just didn't talk about it. It was something that maybe the family discussed, you know, but you just didn't hear much about breast cancer. And then if you fast forward to the 1990s, an example that I have is my mother-in-law had had a mastectomy, and my daughter was very young, and she walked in to my mother-in-law's bedroom when she was changing, and my daughter's like, "Grandma, what happened?" Mm-hmm. And she was really shocked, and her grandmother sat her down and said, "You know, this is what happened. This is my prosthetic." And then when I was age 41 and I was going through reconstruction after having a double mastectomy, I took my daughter with me to the appointments. So sure. She knew how things had advanced because she had saw what kind of surgery her grandmother had had in the past. And it's like I wanted her to be reassured things had made an improvement. And it's like that comfort of her being involved in my journey.
Dr. Hines, what do you do with patients in Jacksonville? Are you someone who is sitting there with them? Are you a surgeon? How do you work with patients in breast cancer?
I'm in internal medicine, and I've been working in our breast clinic. So I have a special interest in breast care, breast diseases, breast cancer, and I work in our breast clinic. I serve a variety of roles. Some of it is diagnostic. When someone comes in and they have a lump or nipple discharge, or an abnormal mammogram, and they're concerned, I guide them through the process to diagnose the problem and help get that person on the right track medically. Sure. Other times, I counsel patients who have family history about risk. We look at risk there. We perform an individualized risk assessment. We look at the patient's risk. We talk about management strategies. I help to coordinate genetic testing and perform some of the genetic counseling on patients who are concerned about having a genetic predisposition. And I do much work with newly diagnosed breast cancer patients and work with survivors as well.
Well, let's talk about that risk part of it, because I think the genetics component is, as Tony was saying, you know, back in the 80s, nobody even said it's just the big C. You didn't even talk about cancer. But now we can know more about our genetics and what the family history plays into that. And how do you manage the risk for some of these patients? I mean, this is a new concept for patients to handle.
It is. And I would start by saying that it is such a shame that people didn't talk about this before. I have women who come in with concerns about family history or concerns about their risk, and they really know nothing about their family because people just did not talk about it or did not want to talk about it. So that's a real limitation for us when we're trying to look at someone's risk.
Yeah, when you were looking at the family history, if it was never talked about, there's no way for you to know it.
Absolutely. Women will say, "Well, my mom went off, she had a surgery, she came back without a breast and never talked about it."
Wow.
Or, you know, my aunt died, nobody talked about it, nobody mentioned anything, so I really don't know why she died. And it would make a huge difference for us to know if it was a breast cancer or not.
So what do you, how do you work through this with patients? I mean, right at this point, anybody that comes through, they're not getting their genetics tested first. I mean, you don't know your genome as a starting point.
Right. So what we do is we take the patient's history. We look at all factors, including age, whether someone's on hormones. We look at her reproductive history. We look at whether she's had breast biopsies. But another key piece is looking at the family history. So we look at those individuals, you know, who in the family has had breast cancer, at what age were they diagnosed, was it just on one side or another side, did anyone have ovarian cancer, or are there other cancers in the family? And if we see a pattern that suggests there may be a genetic predisposition, then we can facilitate the genetics the genetic testing. So those patients are screened in the breast clinic. Otherwise, whether we see a genetic predisposition or not, we calculate that person's risk based on some of those factors that I just mentioned.
Based on
how high or low that risk is, then we talk about management.
Explain how ovarian cancer has any bearing whatsoever on breast cancer.
The two most common genes that are associated with a hereditary risk for breast cancer are BRCA1 and BRCA2. Those significantly increase a woman's lifetime risk of getting breast cancer. They also increase the risk for getting, for example, a breast cancer on the other breast, and they increase the risk for ovarian cancer. So there are patients or families who have a family history of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. If that's been diagnosed in the same woman or if it's in the same family, then we are more likely to be concerned about the presence of one of those gene abnormalities.
Well, the million-dollar question then is, if you go through this risk, not the genetics component, but the risk assessment, and you realize that you have a higher risk than maybe the other women in the waiting room, what do you do at that point?
So we look at risk over different time intervals. We look at a woman's risk over the next 5 years. We also look at her lifetime risk. Generally, for most women, we recommend a mammogram and an MRI. A mammogram and a breast exam every year. If you have an elevated risk of breast cancer over your lifetime, based on family history, those criteria are actually pretty specific, then we can add an MRI to your screening regimen. The MRI is a diagnostic is a tool that we use to screen women who have breast cancer. It's probably the most definitive test that have to date that we use clinically that has been found to pick up breast cancers that mammograms might not pick up on.
So you get your mammogram first, though, and if there's something they're not quite sure, then you would get an MRI?
Well, if someone has, the American Cancer Society published a statement in 2007, basically telling women that if they have an telling physicians that if a woman has an elevated lifetime risk of breast cancer, using very specific criteria, then she should get an MRI with her mammogram every year, even if the mammogram is normal. So, for example, if a woman has a BRCA mutation or if she meets the criteria for this elevated risk, then we would talk to her about the benefit of adding an MRI and performing an MRI and a mammogram every year.
I should say that I just about blew right past our golden opportunity to ask you our myth or matter of fact question, which lots of people on Facebook have been commenting on, and that is, a family history of breast cancer means you are likely to develop breast cancer too. Is that a myth or is that a matter of fact?
The reality is that 70 to 75% of women who get breast cancer have no family history of it.
Wow.
So the majority of times it occurs sporadically, and we may not ever know why. Now this is part of the research that may be going on, looking at the genomics of tumors to decide if we can find reasons why this is happening. But only 5 to 10% of all breast cancers are felt to be related to what we would call an inherited predisposition, or something that you inherited from your family.
So among the women that you see in your clinic, what percentage of the women who have a question of rule out breast cancer, for example, what percentage of those women are having that question asked based upon screening mammography, and what percentage roughly are actually discovering these tumors on their own, and what's the difference in how late they present in the stage of the disease?
That's a good question. I see more women coming in with the family history. I probably don't have a specific number. I see more women coming in who have a family history, who have concerns about the gene, than women who I would be suspicious of having the gene.
Okay.
So there is much awareness about family history, and it is a misconception that if you don't have a family history, you don't have to worry.
Okay.
And because most breast cancers occur sporadically.
What is the family history when it comes to men getting breast cancer? Because we hear, sometimes it's just a random story that, there was a man who had breast cancer. How does family history play into that?
Male breast cancer accounts for about 1% of all breast cancers, but BRCA2 mutations are associated with an increased risk of male breast cancer. So the risk to the general population is far less than 1% for getting breast cancer, male breast cancer. But the risk goes up as high as 6% lifetime risk for men. So when we see a man with breast cancer, then the next question is immediately, what is the family history? Is there any breast cancer or ovarian cancer in the family? Pancreatic cancer can be seen with as well as melanomas may be seen. So we look at the family history, and being a man with a diagnosis of breast cancer is reason enough without any other family history to consider genetic testing.
What are the risk factors for male breast cancer? Are the same as they are for women? Is it?
The risk factors are much the same. Radiation exposure, potentially hormone exposure if there was ever a reason to be on hormones, or family history. Men with Klinefelter syndrome may be at elevated risk as well.
And we are almost at our first break here that we need to take. But what are some of the treatment options that are new for women that are being newly diagnosed? How have those changed?
The treatments that we have now, usually we start with surgery, and then we offer additional measures to try to reduce the risk of developing a subsequent surgery. There are developments in the surgical area and the radiation area to perform less intensive, less invasive surgery. The medical part of treatment has developed and become more individualized. So rather than giving everyone a mastectomy or giving everyone the same type of chemotherapy afterward, they've learned that there are markers in individual tumors that are different from one woman to another. So if one woman has estrogen receptors, we can target those estrogen receptors and provide her hormonal-based therapy.
You're
if
listening.
If another woman has the overexpression of HER2,
Dr. Hines,
protein, then we can offer her Herceptin.
We need to take a quick break. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's news from University of Missouri researchers that shows resveratrol, a substance found in grape skins and red wine, can make certain tumor cells more susceptible to radiation treatment. The researchers studied melanoma cells after similar results were found for prostate cancer. They say the next step is to figure out how to deliver the substance to tumor sites and potentially treat many types of cancer. Now, the study found that melanoma cells become more susceptible to radiation if they were treated first with resveratrol. They say it's likely not helpful for advanced melanoma at this time. They also say resveratrol supplements are available over the counter, but they say people should not rely on the supplements to treat cancer because more research is needed. In the future, they may conduct clinical trials with the hope of developing new treatments for cancer. And this study was published in the Journal of Surgical Research. And in other news, as baby boomers enter their retirement years, healthcare costs for complex and debilitating conditions such as Alzheimer's disease are expected to soar. Not drawing as much attention is the likelihood of similarly rising expenses for common age-related medical procedures. A Mayo Clinic study looked at one of those, cataract surgery, and found that more people are getting the vision-improving procedure, seeking it at younger ages, and having both eyes repaired within a few months, rather than only treating one eye. Here's Dr. Jay Erie.
What we found is that cataract surgery rates are rising in all age groups between age 50 and 90, but the greatest increase is in the 70 and 80 year olds. And part of that is that our older population, or the aging baby boomers, are working longer, they want to be more active, they have more demands on their vision, they have to drive at night, the traffic's busier, and they need to see better. And that's why they're looking for surgery sooner so that they can remain independent, remain active, continue to work.
Finding ways to maximize the outcome and minimize the cost to society. And finally, do you know anybody who just seems to see the world negatively? Well, it may not be that they're just moody. Researchers found it could be they have a gene that predisposes them to see the world more darkly. Researchers from the University of British Columbia found people with this gene perceive events, especially negative ones, more vividly. They may be more likely to, for example, pick out mean-looking faces in a crowd or see hazards instead of natural beauty. They say this finding shows more about how our genetic genetic makeup affects how we perceive things. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. We've got information you want from specialists who know on air, online, and on iHeartRadio.
Time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by telephone at 507-282-1234, or you can contact us by going to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org.
Of course, you can also tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And Dr. Hines, we did get a tweet for you, and the question is, why not just skip the mammogram and go straight to MRI?
That's a very good question, and that's one I get a lot in the clinic. Mammography is still the one recommended screening tool, and it's based on what the questions about what makes a good screening test. It's very well standardized, and the process is similar from one place to another. MRIs are a newer technology. They're not as widely available, and there's a tremendous difference in procedure and the machine and the equipment and the size of the magnet and the computer protocols that are used. So it's not as well a standardized procedure. So the same test is not necessarily going to provide the same results from one place to another.
It's also
much more expensive, and there still are findings that you can find on mammogram that you may not see on the MRI, such as calcifications.
I should say I jumped right into speaking with Dr. Hines. I didn't introduce her again. Dr. Stephanie Hines is from the Breast Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. And also joining us here in studio is Tony K. Manscal from the Cancer Education Program at Mayo Clinic. And Tony, once patients are diagnosed, that's when you get involved.
Correct.
So we started talking about mammograms and how important those are. And of course, that by the time the patients come to see you, they've kind of already gotten through that point. But what do you help them then with at the Cancer Education Center?
We have a very large library with a variety of resources and very knowledgeable staff. There's materials that if people are into reading that can be helpful. But what I found very helpful is I joined a support group. And there are a lot of breast cancer survivor support groups out there. And when I was trying to make a decision on do I want to have surgery or not, I talked with other women and I said, why did you make this decision? And why did someone choose reconstruction and another person didn't? So I think joining a support group is very helpful besides talking with your doctor and other professionals. Another thing that I did to cope with some of the side effects from the treatment was I joined something called dragon boating.
Oh, yes.
And dragon boating is a sport that's been around for about 2,500 years, but back in the mid-1990s, there was some research that showed that if you had surgery or you had radiation, something that would help with something called lymphedema, which is swelling that can occur, the accumulation of fluid. Dragon boating is something that can either prevent that or help ease those symptoms.
And you actually are in a boat that looks like a dragon. And here in Rochester, you're going up and down the Zumbro River.
Yep. And I love the sport so much that I actually formed a team at Mayo Clinic here in Rochester. And Mayo Clinic has two dragon boat teams now. One in Arizona and one here in Minnesota.
And one of the other things that you concentrate on at the Cancer Education Program is the research angle of things.
Mm-hmm.
And why would women, I mean, the last thing probably that they're thinking of once they are newly diagnosed with breast cancer is to get involved in research.
Yep.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. So I talk with thousands of patients that call in from all around the world wanting to know about the latest treatments and research options. And the best time for someone to consider participating in research is when they're newly diagnosed. When a patient starts to have a variety of treatments, it can limit the amount of studies that someone would be eligible for. So I encourage newly diagnosed patients to, you want to know what your treatment options are, but then clinical trials should be something that's on the table and have that discussion with your provider who knows your history. So research, you can participate in many different ways. You can give permission to have your medical records reviewed. You can participate in treatment studies. You can participate in symptom management studies. Maybe you're experiencing fatigue or nausea, or you're having some other side effect from the treatment. It's very easy to participate in research that's called epidemiology, where maybe we send you a survey and you don't even have to come to a Mayo Clinic location to participate. We have a universal phone number that people can call all around the world, and that number is 507-538-7623. Let me repeat that one more time. It's 507-538-7623. And if people call in and they want to know about the latest treatments at Mayo Clinic, the latest research, they will have someone call them back very quickly.
Why should someone participate in research?
Well, what's interesting, if you look at the percentage of adults that participate in cancer clinical trials, it's about 3%. Mm-hmm. And if you look at children that participate in cancer clinical trials, the percentages are between 80 to 90%. And for children's cancer, there have been some amazing advancements.
Great
strides. Mm-hmm. Yep. If you look at acute, a type of leukemia called ALL, acute lymphocytic leukemia. And so we need to make adults more aware that clinical trials are an option. Just this morning, I was walking by a lot of the buildings at, on the Mayo Clinic campus that are conducting amazing research. We have overall over 9,000 studies underway at Mayo Clinic, and out of those, about 1,000 are cancer-related.
Wow.
So you do not have to come to a Mayo Clinic location to participate. Our research is very global. And we are glad to provide information, and we need to make those advancements.
We need to go to the phones to answer some questions. 507-282-1234. Dean is on the line. Good morning, Dean. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
I just thought about Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and another part of it is Breast Cancer Prevention Month. And one part of that is just the need to encourage men and women is to stay slim. I read a study by the American Institute of Cancer Research estimates that 17% of breast cancer, that's 33,000 new cases per year, are due to excess weight alone. And women who are obese when diagnosed are more likely to die from breast cancer.
Dr. Hines, would you agree with our very smart and savvy listeners that weight is a big issue when it comes to breast cancer?
Yes, there have been a variety of studies that have looked at weight and risk for breast cancer, as well as weight and things like exercise and dietary intake in terms of survival after a diagnosis. And the consensus has been that weight gain over time or during someone's adulthood will increase the risk of cancer. The reason for that is not very clear at this point, and that is a focus for research as well. But keeping yourself within the sort of the normal range for your body type or your size, your height, and exercising regularly are a key feature of prevention, and something people can do easily and that doesn't really cost anything.
Tony?
I just want to mention we were talking about breast cancer awareness, but an important issue is access to have a mammogram. And there are programs for women that are underinsured or not insured mm-hmm. that in each state through their Department of Health so that women can have access to get that mammogram, and that's very important, access to care.
Very good. Well, thank you for calling in, Dean.
Yep, thank you.
I love those listeners that they're watching out for these things.
They're doing the research.
They do the research for us. That's
Google
right.
It.
So what about more of the patients getting those mammograms, Tony? You said, you know, one of the things you wanted to make sure people understood was getting the mammogram is the key.
It is. So, you know, I was 40 when I was very fortunate to have a doctor who said, Tony, even though you don't have a family history, you're going for your mammogram. At age 41, my doctor, again, he said, I'm ordering this mammogram. You need to go for it. And that's where, because I had that baseline mammogram, that initial mammogram at age 40, they could see the changes. So the continuity of having those mammograms is very important so that if there are any changes, it's noted.
Could you clear up some of this controversy that was created with the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force and the different screening recommendations and just tell women right now what they should do?
Yep. I'm a very active volunteer with the American Cancer Society. That's another thing that I started to get involved with. And the American Cancer Society, along with Mayo Clinic, recommend that women over that are age 40 or over get their mammogram every year.
Dr. Hines, let's talk for a moment. Previously, we had mentioned the MRI, and one of the reasons it would call for that would be dense breasts. And explain to women why dense breasts can make a particular I don't know, particular caution when it comes to detecting breast cancer?
There are two reasons. The first, when a woman has very dense breasts, it makes mammography more difficult from the standpoint that it decreases sensitivity. So when a radiologist says, this is benign, I see no change, I see no evidence of breast cancer, we're less sure of that. That's just because it is easier for a growing tumor to basically hide in that dense tissue than it would be for a woman who has very fatty breasts.
And does
so
it make
it may make imaging and detection more challenging.
When it comes to dense breasts, does it make a difference if you're older or younger or larger or smaller? I mean, how is that diagnosed, I guess, that you have
the dense breasts?
Are
identified on the mammogram. Basically, it changes the look of the mammogram. So you know if you have dense breasts when you look at the mammogram, and the radiologists have a certain terminology that they use to define how dense it is. They might say extreme, they may say this is predominantly fatty breast or scattered glandular tissue, heterogeneously dense or extremely dense. So if they say extremely dense, you have dense breasts.
And that's
the
when you would...
The other limitation with that is it's just the risk. There have been some studies that have indicated that women who have very dense breasts have a higher risk of breast cancer than women who have the most fatty breasts. So there are two reasons for concern.
You know, it is very important that women know their breast density. And there's an organization called RU Dense, and it's just a wonderful website to get information on breast density.
So one of the things that I do a lot as a primary care provider is I try to counsel my patients during that time that they get the call back. So they get the mammography, and then they get some abnormality reading, and then they get the call back. That seems to be a very tense time. And I'm just wondering if anybody's aware of what the rates of callback are and what percentage of them are positive or negative.
Dr. Hines, why don't you start with that? What are the rates of callback?
The rates of callback are... I would imagine it's different at different facilities.
Sure.
The way we do it at Mayo here, our rates of callback are smaller because most of the time the diagnostic testing that's required or requested after the screening mammogram is performed on site. So here what happens is that we do all of it in one day rather than having to, quote, call back the patient. But the majority of times when there is a callback, whether it's an additional mammogram, an ultrasound, or even a biopsy, the majority of times those callbacks are negative.
Yeah, from my own experience, when I had an abnormal mammogram, I remember being walked down to the consultation room. The doctor came in the room. She said, I am doctor. And after she said the word doctor, I don't remember anything that she said. And then I went back to my office, which was a couple floors down in the building, and continued to talk to patients about their cancer diagnosis.
Wow.
A little later, I'm just like, something happened, you know, earlier. Maybe I should call them back. So there's that numbness. And even though I have a knowledge base, there's that shock of, what did I just hear?
Which I think I wanted to very quickly bring up then, that support system that you have along with you. And Tony, you could probably touch on this a little bit more, because you do want to have someone who goes with you to help be a second set of ears to listen to what your physician is telling you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very fortunate to have some staff that I worked with that would go with me to appointments, my family members when they were available to be there. But the most important thing is that you reach out and you connect with other people when you have questions, and use your healthcare team to run those questions by, because they know your history, and so it's just important for that you have someone that can listen and help you with information.
Dr. Hines, as we're wrapping things up here, let's finish up by talking about prevention and start with detection, though, because we've talked about mammogram and MRIs and self-exam. Let's just talk about that a little bit more. What do you advise women when it comes to BSEs?
I advise women to perform their breast self-examinations. Now, I won't beat someone up if they're not doing it, because my experience is the vast majority of women are very uncomfortable doing it. They don't know what they're supposed to be feeling for.
Well, it can be confusing for them, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
Right.
Yeah.
People are asked to look for lumps, and then they check their breast, and they feel lumps everywhere. That's the most common experience that I hear about. And it's true that there is glandular tissue. There are ligaments in the breast. There's fatty tissue in the breast. You have ductal structures. So there is
a lot going on in there. The real key is to become familiar with what your breasts normally feel like. And I tell women, if you can get to the point where you can almost predict what you're going to feel before you actually touch your breast, then you're comfortable with your breast exam. And if something changes, you will notice it.
And is there a certain time of the month that we want women to do this?
But there doesn't have to be. Okay. Often things may be less tender, less full and swollen, and less lumpy after a period.
Okay.
So that may be...
And that's a good reminder for women.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then they come in, they're doing their breast self-exams, they come in for their annual mammograms starting at age 40. And then what? Anything else that they can do for detection?
Just making sure that you have your breast exam performed by your physician, the mammogram, and just being aware of your own breast health are probably... The real core. It's those three things together for most women.
Very good.
The second part is risk assessment, looking at risk and offering women who have a higher risk a little bit more.
Cheryl has a quick question for us. Good morning, Cheryl. Welcome to the program. Go right ahead. Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if there's some kind of test a woman can do at home to determine her risk, like some kind of a scoring system.
Ah, so doing her own family history assessment risk. Is there anything like that, Dr. Hines?
There are scoring systems that we use, and that's how we calculate risk. These are all different, and most of them are available online.
Huh.
For example, the Gale model is available on the web. It's at nci.gov, I believe, and it's a way to assess breast risk. I caution, though, because each model has its inherent
sure.
limitations. So no one model is perfect for everybody.
So it starts the conversation.
Right.
Thank you so much, Cheryl.
Thank you.
And as we're finishing up here, what are the final things that people can do to prevent breast cancer, Dr. Hines?
Well, some of it is lifestyle, as our caller mentioned, exercise, weight. We also look at awareness, screening, looking at risk factors, and prevention. The thing we didn't talk about much that is an option would be the concept of using a medication to reduce your risk. There are three options that are available today, not just tamoxifen.
Very good. Dr. Stephanie Hines from the Breast Clinic at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, and Tony Manskow from the Cancer Education Program. Thank you so much for being here, both of you.
Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll talk about next week's program. Stay with us.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Shives will be back. And so we're very happy to have you here, Dr. Ebert.
I love
let me just
being
say.
Here. This is great.
And before we talk about next week's program, let me say that for more information on breast cancer and risk and assessment and research and all those things, go to mayoclinic.com and .org. There's spots in both places. Also, breastcancertrials.org, force.org, which has to do with facing your risk of cancer empowered. And rudense.org. Those are all websites that we mentioned during the program. I will put them all on our webpage. You'll be able to find that at radio.mayoclinic.org. Okay, next week, we're going to talk about suicide prevention. So this is the Twitter chat that I was part of a month or so ago during Suicide Prevention Week. And Dr. Tim Lineberry and Dr. Michael Bostwick will be here. Of course,
it's an uncomfortable topic to talk about.
Never have we actually covered it on this program before. We have done brief little quick chats, but we've never used it as a whole topic and had someone in here to discuss it. And one of the things, the rate of military suicide that is increasing so quickly. Yes.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
So we'll be covering all of those, and we hope that you'll join us.
For more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website at radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program as well as previously aired Mayo Clinic radio episodes.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director is Kim David. The theme music written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic, I'm Tracy McRae, and you're Dr. John Ebert.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.